So thank you for the invitation, Alain. I will follow up with Huntington's disease. And today I'd like to talk about this question that has been already asked during this day about the vulnerability of the striatum in this disease. So in fact, we are interested in this key question in neurodegenerative disease is that when you look at the different brain regions that are affected in those different diseases, for example, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, or Huntington's disease, there's no clear-cut match or overlap between the regions that are the mostly affected and the pattern of expression of the gene products that have been genetically linked to those disorders. For example, in Parkinson's disease, you've heard that the substantia nigra pars compacta degenerate quite early, and there's no match with the different genes that have been identified, such as PINK, alpha synuclein, LRRK2, or DGON. Those genes have no particular expression in the substantia nigra, although this region will degenerate very early. So it's quite the same for Huntington's disease, where the striatum is one of the earliest affected region, and the gene product mutant huntingtin is expressed through the cerebral cortex and the striatum as well. Okay, so I will not go through this slide because you know everything on Huntington's disease, thanks to Alexandra this morning and Frederick. But importantly, there's no efficient, no efficacious treatment for this devastating disorder. So we really need to pursue this analysis of the mechanism underlying the pathogenesis of Huntington's disease. So I'd like to focus a little bit on striatal degeneration. So we know, as Alexandra already showed very elegantly this morning, from the study of longitudinal study of cohort of HD patients using MRI morphometry, that the striatum is one of the first regions that show atrophy, even in patients, even in gene carriers that have no symptoms yet. So we can predict that even more than 10 years before the onset of the disease, the striatum is already damaged. At least there's a detectable atrophy. The disease will progress toward a stronger atrophy of the striatum, as it has been shown. So you see here the atrophy of the striatum. Of course, this is not only a brain disease, and there's many evidence now that the patients have a lot of disturbance at the level of the heart, muscle, and the immune system. But the striatum is one of the first region to be affected. When the disease progresses, it's characterized by the atrophy, which is linked to the degeneration of the medium-sized spiny neurons, the loss of dendritic spines, and then the disappearance of the neurons, the death of neurons. So there's different ways to look at that. And even when you look and you study those different models, genetic models, such as here, I took an example from the lab that has been recently studied by Gilles Bonventou in the lab. So this is the BACHD model. So they express the full-length human mutant huntingtin with 87 CAG repeat under the promoter, the human promoter. Those mice have a very weak phenotype, actually. They have almost no clear-cut motor sign. There's no atrophy of the striatum, even when you look at a large number of animals. Here you have the volume of the striatum in those mice at 12 months of age. There's no atrophy, even when you look in vivo using MRI. But when you start to look at the function, here this is a 3D reconstruction of the autoradiography for glucose uptake in the striatum using 2DG. Then you see that there's a very small local loss, local reduction of the glucose uptake in those animals, very subtle but significant in the dorsolateral part of the striatum, indicating that again in this model, the striatum is one of the first region to be affected. So the mutant huntingtin leads to a number of different changes in the cell. It produces gain of function and as well, as we've heard, loss of function. One of the very early events is the perturbation, disturbance of transcription through a number of different changes involving transcription factors and more generally the changes in chromatin compaction through deregulation of acetylase, histone acetylase, and histone deacetylase. So this early change and other changes in the cell produce a number of different abnormality involving autophagy, the proteasome aggregation, leading to different changes. And Frederick gave very convincing evidence that, of course, there's a major impact on the transport of vesicles, especially from the cortex to the striatum. There's strong evidence also that there's an early change, an early defect in energy metabolism, and this is, I would say, a general phenomenon in the disease, both in the brain and in periphery, probably. And there's some evidence for specific mitochondrial changes. But in fact, none of those mechanisms can really account for this striatal vulnerability when we think about it. So there's different hypotheses. I just summarized three of those most famous hypotheses. One has been brilliantly exposed by Frederick, that the corticostriatal pathway that goes from the cortex to the striatum plays a major role, both because this is linked to a mechanism that could be linked to glutamate deregulation, an excitotoxic mechanism killing the cells, and also this very important role that BDNF plays on the survival of striatal cells, and so that the defect in BDNF transport secretion and then the activation of the TRAC receptor could play. And so this is probably an important aspect of the disease. We've been studying for a long time the what we call the mitochondrial hypothesis, or I would say the metabolic hypothesis in the Huntington's disease. And this is linked with the observations that, in fact, when you look through the literature in experimental neurology or in neurology, a number of even genetic or environmental cause leading to energy compromise, severe energy compromise affecting the mitochondria, leads to preferential striatal degeneration in the caudate and the putamen. But I will not talk about this part of our work today. I'd like to concentrate on the third hypothesis, which is a more broad general hypothesis. We think that there's a sort of complex set of genes, or gene products, I should say, that may be involved in the disease as a sort of risk factors for Huntington, mutant Huntington toxicity. So there's different way to talk about this possible hypothesis. In fact, as I told you, there's a number of transcripts in the disease in HD patients or in the striatum in animal models where you see a number of gene products that are downregulated. So, for example, if you take one gene product in the striatum that has a sort of pro-survival effect, its downregulation will lead to a sort of loss of protection. And then the loss of this marker would lead to an increased vulnerability of striatal cells as compared to other cells in the brain that do not express this factor. On the contrary, if one given a gene product is protoxic and you have a downregulation of this, you could think it's neuroprotective, but then this product is still present in the cell and may provide a sort of risk factor, although as compared to other cells that do not express at all or at very low level this pro-toxic gene product. So when we look at the literature and we try to list the different genes that have preferential expression in the striatum, the list is quite short, actually, as compared to the striatal complexity, the molecular complexity of the striatum. But then we know that there's, for example, gene products such as the D2 receptor that are downregulated in the disease. But we know also that the presence of those receptors probably is a risk factor, because we know it will increase the toxicity of mutant huntingtin in different models. And this has been shown also for the protein RES in very nice studies recently. There's, on the contrary, gene products that are, for example, membrane receptors such as the adenosine A2A receptors that are downregulated, but those are protective per se. So the downregulation will increase the vulnerability of cells to mutant huntingtin, and those may contribute to vulnerability of striatal cells in Huntington's disease. But then again, when you look at the list of those genes, it's a quite short list. And so we were interested a long time ago in the complexity, in improving our knowledge of the complexity of the striatum. Oops, sorry. And so for this, we started a study where we wanted to more precisely and quite quantitatively determine the level of expression of different transcripts in different brain regions. So we dissected that different small brain region in the normal mouse brain, and we analyzed the transcriptome of those different regions using SAGE analysis. In fact, at that time, it was a relatively powerful, quite tedious but powerful way to look and rank at the level of expression, the different genes that you could look at. So now it's something you can run very rapidly using, for example, RNA-seq. But so at that time, we were able, using this approach, to compare the different brain regions and to find out what sort of genes, what was the list of genes that were preferentially expressed in the striatum in the normal mouse brain. And to make that, we had a quite simple filter. We looked at the genes that were at least five, which have an expression level of five times higher as compared to the three other brain regions. So it was a kind of stringent filter. So we ended up with a list of approximately 120, 150, depending on the analysis, genes for which the expression is preferential in the striatum, within the striatum. So this is just a part of this list. What was really interesting and quite intriguing at that time is that, of course, we found gene products that were known to be striatal, such as the phosphodiesterase, methencephaline, substance P, adenylate cyclase, and the D2 receptor, for example. But there was a large number of gene products that had no known function, especially absolutely no known function in the brain, such as, for example, this orphan receptor or this regulatory protein of G proteins. And there was this transmembrane protein capucin that we studied also. I will talk about that later. So it was quite amazing to see that, in fact, in the adult brain, most of the genes that are present are absolutely not known, and we have no clue about their neurobiological function. In the lower part of the list as well, we could find gene products that were known, such as the D1 receptor, and there was also this ADORA2 gene products, which codes for the A2A adenosine receptor. So those have a very low level of expression, but they are, for example, for this, very famous and highly enriched into the striatum. And then, again, we found a large number of genes. I didn't put all those genes. We had a large list of genes for which we had absolutely no idea about the function. And at that time, we find, for example, LRRK2, which is the most frequent cause of genetic Parkinson's disease. So we identified this gene as a striatal marker, although it's involved in Parkinson's disease. And we found also gene products that probably do not code for a protein, such as this RIKEN, which is in fact a non-coding RNA we talk about later. So we were trying to see what we could do with this list. It's always the same story when you end up with a large list. So what we did, in fact, since we wanted to know whether those different striatal specific genes could play a role in the vulnerability of the striatum against mutant huntingtin, we decided to pick up the genes that were downregulated in Huntington disease model or in HD patients, in the code 8 of HD patients. We really wanted to focus on gene products that for which we had confirmation in the human brain or the macaque brain that this enrichment in the striatum was real. We also limited our study to clonable gene products so that we could use viral vectors to do functional studies. And since we were kind of wanting to have fun, we decided to go to quite unknown functions. So we wanted to start from scratch and we pick up genes for which we had no idea about the function. And so we asked a simple question, and we asked whether the downregulation of those gene products could produce something on mutant huntingtin. And so for this, we had to go to in vivo experiments, because all those genes that we picked up and most of the list of genes you see in the adult striatum and that are marker of the striatum are not expressed in vitro cells. Even if you try to differentiate the cells and you try to keep your striatal, embryonic striatal culture for weeks, there's no way to see those markers. So we decided to go in vivo, and for this we use this very simple model that uses viral vectors. So in fact we inject viral vectors coding for mutant huntingtin with 82 poly Q in the striatum, and so we mixed this viral vector with a viral vector coding for the candidates that we wanted to test, or a vector that codes for the shRNA targeting, for example, this candidate. And then after a few weeks, you can look at the striatum and see the lesion that is produced by mutant huntingtin looking at different markers of the striatum. So you see the lesions, you can make a 3D reconstruction and morphometric analysis of the lesion. And so you can decide, you can determine precisely the size of the lesion in a group of animals and see whether your candidate has changed significantly or not this lesion. And so this is what we've done for a number of different striatal candidate striatal genes. And at first we were quite disappointed because we started with this protein, capucin, which was the TEM90A gene, because this gene has a very high level of expression in the striatum. So it's much above D2 receptor or D1 receptor. So it's a very highly expressed gene. So we did the knockdown, we did the overexpression experiment, and in fact this gene produced, at least in our model, no modification of mutant huntingtin toxicity. We, with our collaborator at CA, we made also a knockout for this this protein, and there was no change in the susceptibility of the striatum to mutant huntingtin. So at first we were disappointed, but at least we had, I would say, a good control. Is that with all those tools, we knew that by chance the protein are not all protective or protoxic against mutant huntingtin. And then we studied another interesting candidate, which is this long intergenic non-coding RNA, which is called ABDH11OS. we showed that indeed it's really a non-coding RNA, so there's no way to pick up a detectable peptide codes by this gene products. And we found that this, when it's overexpressed, is really neuroprotective. And when you knock down this with an shRNA strategy, it's increasing the toxicity of mutant huntingtin in vivo. We did the same with other proteins, such as CREAM, which is a protein very well known by the people interested in endocrinology, and because it's the protein that transport the tyrosine T3 and T4 hormone from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. And we demonstrated that CREAM is neuroprotective when it's overexpressed against mutant huntingtin. And today it led us to concentrate on one very interesting candidate, which we call DCLK3. So the DCLK3 is part of a family of double cortin kinases, the most famous being DCLK1 and DCLK2, that has a relatively ubiquitous expression within the brain, whereas DCLK3 is preferentially expressed in the striatum. So the structure of the protein has those double cortin domain in tandem in DCLK1 and 2. Interestingly, DCLK3 has only one motif, suggesting it has a different function, probably. The kinase domain, which is a serine threonine kinase domain, quite reminiscent of the CAM kinase 2 and CAM kinase 4, is very conserved. And this is only what we know from bioinformatics, but this protein had never been studied before experimentally. So the protein is expressed in the striatum. In fact, now we have access to different set of data, including, for example, the LN brain atlas, or different set of data in the lab. And it's also expressed in the outer layer of the cerebral cortex, also in the dentate gyrus and CA1. Probably it's also expressed in the substantia nigra. So it's not only a purely striatal gene product, but it's, as you see here, quite enriched in the striatum. So the function of the protein is unknown. We know that in mice, we found out, because the bioinformatics couldn't tell, that there's two forms, one with a remnant, an older double cortin domain, but the short forms have completely lost the double cortin domain, especially in the macaque and the human. So the function is unclear. The kinase remain, depending on the species we are looking at, the kinase domain is really highly conserved. So we checked in different models that the expression indeed was reduced. Here, this is in the Nokin 140 CHD mice. there's a significant reduction of expression in those animals when they start to have symptoms at 8 months of age. And so we made those different constructs, as I explained you, shRNA, bicistronic to be also able to express GFP, and we made different constructs to express, overexpress DCLK3, the long form and the short form in mice. So those tools were first assessed for the efficacy in vivo. And then we made the experiment by mixing those viral vectors with mutant huntingtin coding vectors. We made the assessment using a quantitative histology, and we found that when the protein was well expressed in the striatum, there was reduction of the lesion that was significant with the short form and with the long form of DCLK3. So it showed, depending on whatever the different markers we use, that it was really efficient to protect the striatal cells against mutant huntingtin. Interestingly, we looked also at the number of aggregates that are produced by mutant huntingtin, and there was no change, indicating that there's no direct interaction with the aggregation process of the mutant huntingtin we overexpress with the lentiviral vectors. We did the experiment in, I would say, in mirror using the shRNA. So in this case, we used the advantage that this viral vector code for GFP. So the level of GFP you see gives you an idea of the health of the neurons you are transducing. So here you have the level of fluorescence, for example, for the shRNA coding DCLK3. We managed to have the same quantity of viral vectors injected in the striatum with this viral vector coding for the control shRNA, which is also bicistronic for GFP. Here, this is when you inject with mutant huntingtin, so you have a reduction of the fluorescence because the cells are not dying, but at least suffering. And you have an aggravation of this degeneration when you have the shRNA targeting the CLK3. So here, this is 3 weeks after the injection, and here it's 6 weeks where the similar phenomenon can be observed. And using different markers, we could verify that indeed shRNA targeting this protein is pro-toxic. So in summary, the CLK3 downregulation would be in the disease protoxic, so it would increase the vulnerability of striatal cells to the disease process. And then we just ask through an experiment that is ongoing, using the Nokin mice, 140 CHD mice, whether we could improve the symptoms of those animals by overexpressing DCLK3. So in this case, we used more efficient viral vectors, the AAV10, that codes for either GFP as a control or the long form of DCLK3. We infected the striatum in animals that were 6 months of age. And we looked at the different motor performance that the animal could show in the two groups using conventional tests, using the rotarod test, the open field test. And at 12 months, we repeated the study, and we used also the catwalk, where the animals can be analyzed precisely for their ability to move smoothly over a board. And so we found a significant improvement on the rotarod test with DCLK3, which was still visible but not significant at 12 months of age. And there was always a trend of improvement in the open field grip strength test, and the catwalk test pick up an ability of the animal that was lost when they were transgenic, which is the sort of smoothness of movement. And DCLK3 overexpression improved this smoothness of movement during the test. But then the question was, how does it work? How could DCLK3 produce such a neuroprotective or a beneficial effect, let's say? So we had absolutely no clue. So one possibility was that since the double cortin domain was kind of not well conserved, we thought that probably the KNS domain could be responsible for the protection. So we subclone a truncated protein expressing only the KNS domain, and we found that indeed the overexpression of this KNS domain was neuroprotective against mutant huntingtin. Here, this is using Nguyen marker. Here, it's cyclotochrome C oxidase marker. So the KNS domain looked as if it was sufficient to protect against mutant huntingtin. So then we asked whether it was only the domain in terms of protein domain, or if it was also not only the domain, but its activity, its catalytic activity. So we made some alignment, comparison, bioinformatic analysis to pick up a lysine that seems to be very important for the function of this kinase. And we made a substitution of this lysine, and we checked that indeed this lysine led to a dead kinase. So here you have the autophosphorylation assay, where using radioactive ATP, you can pick up autophosphorylation of the kinase domain. And when there's a mutation, the substitution, You see there's no longer autophosphorylation. Here this kinase substrate phosphorylation assay where you see phosphorylation using DCLK3, the wild type form, and you see that the mutant form has no longer is no longer able to phosphorylate this substrate. So saying that the protein was a dead kinase. And then we cloned this in viral vectors and we tested in vivo whether it was still able to protect against mutant huntingtin. So here you see that, in fact, the wild-type domain is able to protect, but then the dead kinase domain has lost its protective effect. So probably the kinase domain is very important, and the activity, the functional activity of the protein is necessary to get the protection. And then we tried to start a biological experiment in cells, and I'm going to try to activate this simple. I'm not used with the computer. It's just to activate the video. I have no clue to do it on your computer. No, normally il y a un petit truc de vidéo qui s'est. Ah, c'est ça. Ah, you're too good. Thank you. So it was just to show that, in fact, in red you have the localization of the recombinant DCLK3 protein, which is the long form, and which decorates the cytoskeleton, at least in this type of cells, which are egg cells overexpressing the protein. So at first we thought it was so beautiful, and we were quite influenced by Frédéric Sodou's work on the microtubules and transport, that we were quite focalized on the microtubules, actually. So in fact, it can bind to the microtubules, and we did also a biochemical experiment for enrichment in fraction enriched in microtubules, and in fact both forms of DCLK3 can bind to microtubules, the kinase form, the short form, the long form. So we were kind of surprised. And we incidentally, I would say, looked at different cells that were overexpressing the different forms. In fact, we found that there was a small part of the protein that seems to go to the nucleus, at least when we overexpress the kinase form, which is the kinase domain here in this experiment, where you see that in the nucleus there's still some immunoreactivity for the H attack, because at that time we had no good antibody to detect the protein. So we went to in vivo experiments, and for this we infected mice with the form, the different form here. This is the kinase form of DCLK3 in the striatum. So what you see here in green is the immunoreactivity for this H tag of the protein. So this is in fact only the short kinase domain. So you see the localization within the cytoplasm. There's not much of immunoreactivity in the nucleus, although at those cells there's some. And then when we use the different antibody, we started to look to study that recognize the N-terminal part of the kinase domain. We saw that of course we could see also the cytoplasm, but then there was some labeling in red here that turned out to be in the nucleus. And this is just a magnification showing the localization into a striatal neuron in mice. So then we looked at the localization of this protein using an antibody that recognized this kinase domain in the macaque brain. And we found that using immunohistochemistry, there was some labeling in the striatum. So here we had in the caudate, where the labeling is kind of patchy. There's some cells that have a sort of compact labeling reminiscent of cytoplasmic and possibly a nuclear labeling, and all the cells that are typically devoid of labeling in the nucleus, such as those cells. In the cortex as well, here, we found some labeling in large Purkinje cells, pyramidal neurons. And we wanted to know whether we had really something in the nucleus or not. So we started to work out the detection of this protein, the endogenous level in the macaque brain. So what you see here, for example, is the labeling in red of this protein in the nucleus. So here, this is a nucleus of a very compact nucleus of an astrocyte that is very close to this medium-sized tiny neurons. In green, this is the neuron labeling, and you see the nucleus of the neuron here and the red labeling inside. So it looks as if the protein in vivo might be a little bit in the cytoplasm, and the most part of the protein can be in the nucleus. So since it was possible that the protein finally had an action on the nucleus, what we did is an interaction study to see where or what sort of protein could be partners of this kinase. So we used the kinase domain as a bait for a yeast-2 hybrid screen. We screened the human mRNA, human brain mRNA library, and we ended up with 7 candidates, which are here. There are zinc finger protein. All the proteins, the 7 proteins that we found, are all with domains, zinc finger domains, suggesting a role in transcription. One was quite known, which is TATA3, and this protein is expressed at quite high level in the brain. And this contact with different important proteins regulating transcription, such as transcription activating factors, the TAFs, P53, and some lysine acetylases. So we thought that possibly the way it worked was the way DCLK3 was able to produce neuroprotection was through activation of transcription. And then for this, we made an experiment using embryonic stem cells, human stem cells with Anselm Perrier in stem. So we overexpressed this kinase domain in at a stage where the phenotype was close to striatal cells. And we found many different genes that were differentially expressed and all are connected to chromatin compaction and DNA packaging and nucleosome, suggesting that again the protein is able to play at some level of the transcription and regulation of possibly epigenetic events. So this is just a way to represent the possible interaction, functional interaction between the gene products that have been identified as being regulated by the DCLK3 overexpression. There's one aspect which is quite interesting, is that there's many histones that are regulated in this set of experiments, and that are related to probably the compact the packaging of chromatin. So in summary, we found that the loss of DCLK3 may render striatal neurons more vulnerable to mutant huntingtin. That could be one of the factors that would be involved in this vulnerability in mutant huntingtin toxicity and in the disease, possibly. So we are carrying out experiments to look at DCLK3 localization and level of expression in brain material. And another interesting aspect of this work is that probably DCLK3, which is not only expressed in striatal cells but expressed in many different cells in the brain, in the cerebral cortex and substantia nigra, noticeably, may have a role on the way it could, in fact, integrate some signal at the level of the cytoplasm. And one fragment, I didn't go to the through the biochemical experiments we have done, but one of the fragment is directly going inside the nucleus to regulate transcription and regulate probably chromatin modeling. So I'd like to thank my collaborators that have been involved in this work, especially Laetitia Francel and Laurie Galvan, who did a large part of the experimental work with the lentiviral vectors and with the AAV, and all my collaborators helping in trying to understand what is the role of DCLK3 in this, let's say, story. I thank you for your attention.